Winston Churchill, from Wikipedia, the Free Encyclopedia. Section 12, Last Days. Aware that he was slowing down, both physically and mentally, Churchill retired as Prime Minister in 1955, and was succeeded by Sir Anthony Eden, who had long been his ambitious protégé. 3 years earlier, Eden had married Churchill's niece Anna Clarissa Churchill, Eden's second marriage. Churchill spent most of his retirement at Chartwell and in the south of France. In 1963, Churchill was named the first honorary citizen of the United States by US President John F. Kennedy. Churchill was too ill to attend the White House ceremony, so his son and grandson accepted the award for him. On the 15th of January 1965, Churchill suffered another stroke, a severe cerebral thrombosis, that left him gravely ill. He died 9 days later, on the 24th of January, 1965, 70 years to the day after his father's death. By decree of the Queen, his body lay in state in Westminster Hall for 3 days, and a state funeral service was held at St. Paul's Cathedral. This was the first state funeral for a non-royal family member since that of Field Marshal Lord Roberts of Kandahar in 1914. As his coffin passed down the Thames on the Haven Gore, the cranes of London's Docklands bowed in salute. The Royal Artillery fired a 19-gun salute as head of government, and the RAF staged a flyby of 16 English electric lightning fighters. The state funeral was the largest gathering of dignitaries in Britain, as representatives from over 100 countries attended, including French President Charles de Gaulle, Canadian Prime Minister Lester Pearson, Rhodesian Prime Minister Ian Smith, other heads of state and government, and members of royalty. It also saw the largest assemblage of statesmen in the world until the funeral of Pope John Paul II in 2005. It has been suggested that it was Churchill's wish that, were de Gaulle to outlive him, his, that is Churchill's, funeral procession should pass through Waterloo Station. This is complete myth, though President de Gaulle did attend the service, and the coffin departed for Bladon from Waterloo Station, there is absolutely no connection. In fact, Churchill did not plan his own funerals, commonly believed, but he made a few suggestions, and was part of the committee which made the plans. His codename for it was Operation Hope Not. At Churchill's request, he was buried in the family plot at St. Martin Church, Bladon, near Woodstock, not far from his birthplace at Blenheim. Because the funeral took place on 30th of January, people in the United States marked it by paying tribute to his friendship with Roosevelt, because it was the anniversary of FDR's birth. The tributes were led by Roosevelt's children. On the 9th of February 1965, Churchill's estate was probated at £304,044 sterling, equivalent to about £3.8 million today. Section 13. Churchill as Historian. Churchill was a prolific writer throughout his life, and, during his periods out of office, regarded himself as a professional writer who was also a Member of Parliament. Despite his aristocratic birth, he inherited little money, his mother spent most of his inheritance, and always needed ready cash to maintain his lavish lifestyle and to compensate for a number of failed investments. Some of his historical works, such as A History of the English-Speaking Peoples, were written primarily to raise money. Although Churchill was an excellent writer, he was not trained as a historian. In his youth, he was an avid reader of history, but within a narrow range. The major influences on his historical thought and his prose style were Clarendon's History of the English Civil War, Gibbon's The History of the Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, and Macaulay's History of England. He had little interest in social or economic history. He saw history as essentially political and military, driven by great men rather than by economic forces or social change. Churchill was the last and one of the most influential exponents of Whig history, the belief of the 18th and 19th century Whigs that the British people had a unique greatness and an imperial destiny, and that all British history should be seen as progress towards fulfilling that destiny. This belief inspired his political career as well as his historical writing. It was criticised as an old-fashioned view of history even in Churchill's youth, but he never modified it or showed any interest in other schools of history. Although he employed professional historians as assistants, they had no influence whatsoever over the content of his works. Churchill's historical writings fall into three categories. The first is works of family history, the biographies of his father, Life of Lord Randolph Churchill, from 1906, and of his great ancestor, Marlborough, His Life and Times, which was published in four volumes from 1933 to 38. These are still regarded as fine biographies, but are marred by Churchill's desire to present his subject in the best possible light. He made only limited use of the available source materials, and in the case of his father, suppressed some material from family archives that reflected badly on Lord Randolph. The Marlborough biography shows to the full Churchill's great talent for military history. Both books have been superseded by more scholarly works, but are still highly readable. The second category is Churchill's autobiographical works, including his early journalistic compilations The Story of the Malakand Field Force, from 1898, The River War, from 1899, London to Ladysmith via Pretoria, 1900, and Ian Hamilton's March, also published in 1900. These latter two were reissued in a re-edited form as My Early Life in 1930. All these books are colourful and entertaining, and contain some valuable information about Britain's imperial wars in India, the Sudan, and South Africa. But they are essentially exercises in self-promotion, since Churchill was already a parliamentary candidate in 1900. Churchill's reputation as a writer, however, rests on the third category, his three massive multi-volume works of narrative history. These are his Histories of the First World War, The World Crisis, published in six volumes, 1923-31, of the Second World War, in six volumes from 1948-53, and his History of the English-Speaking Peoples, four volumes 1956-58, much of which, though, had been written in the 1930s. These are among the longest works of history ever published. The Second World War runs to more than 2 million words, and earned him the Nobel Prize for Literature. Churchill's histories of the two world wars are, of course, far from being conventional historical works, since the author was a central participant in both stories, and took full advantage of that fact in writing his books. Both are, in a sense, therefore, memoirs as well as histories, but Churchill was careful to broaden their scope to include events in which he played no part, the war between Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union, for example. Inevitably, however, Churchill placed Britain, and therefore himself, at the centre of his narrative. Arthur Balfour described the world crisis as Winston's brilliant autobiography, disguised as a history of the universe. As a cabinet minister for part of the First World War, and as Prime Minister for nearly all of the Second, Churchill had unique access to official documents, military plans, official secrets, and correspondence between world leaders. After the First War, when there were few rules governing these documents, Churchill simply took many of them with him when he left office and used them freely in his books, as did other wartime politicians, such as David Lloyd George. As a result of this, strict rules were put in place preventing cabinet ministers using official documents for writing history or memoirs once they left office. The world crisis was inspired by Lord Esher's attack on Churchill's reputation in his memoirs. It soon broadened out into a general multi-volume history. The volumes were a mix of military history, written with Churchill's usual narrative flair, diplomatic and political history, often written to justify Churchill's own actions and policies during the war, portraits of other political and military figures, sometimes written to further political vendettas or settle debts, most notably with Lloyd George, and personal memoir, written in a colourful but highly selective manner. Today these books are not in favour as historical references. As with all Churchill's works, they have little to say about economic or social history, and are coloured by his political views, particularly in regard to the Russian Revolution. But they remain highly readable for their narrative skill and vivid portrayals of people and events. When he resumed office in 1939, Churchill fully intended writing a history of the war then beginning. He said several times, "I will leave judgments on this matter to history, but I will be one of the historians." To circumvent the rules against the use of official documents, he took the precaution throughout the war of having a weekly summary of correspondence, minutes, memoranda, and other documents printed in galleys and headed Prime Minister's Personal Minutes. These were then stored at his home for future use. As well, Churchill wrote or dictated a number of letters and memorandums with the specific intention of placing his views on the record for later use as a historian. This all became a source of great controversy when the Second World War began appearing in 1948. Churchill was not an academic historian. He was a politician and was, in fact, leader of the opposition, still intending to return to office. By what right, it was asked, did he have access to cabinet, military, and diplomatic records, which were denied to other historians? What was unknown at the time was the fact that Churchill had done a deal with the Attlee Labour government, which came to office in 1945. Recognising Churchill's enormous prestige, Attlee agreed to allow him, or rather his research assistants, free access to most documents, provided that A. no official secrets were revealed, B. the documents were not used for party political purposes, and C. the typescript was vetted by the Cabinet Secretary, Sir Norman Brooke. Brooke took a close interest in the books, and rewrote some sections himself, to ensure that nothing was said which might harm British interests or embarrass the government. Churchill's history thus became a semi-official one. Churchill's privileged access to documents and his unrivalled personal knowledge gave him an advantage over all other historians of the Second World War for many years. The books had enormous sales in both Britain and the United States, and made Churchill a rich man for the first time. It was not until after his death and the opening of the archives that some of the deficiencies of his work became apparent. Some of these were inherent in the unique position Churchill occupied as a historian, being both a former Prime Minister and a serving politician. He could not reveal military secrets, such as the work of the codebreakers at Bletchley Park, or the planning of the atomic bomb. He could not discuss wartime disputes with figures such as Dwight Eisenhower, Charles de Gaulle, or Tito, since they were still world leaders at the time he was writing. He couldn't discuss cabinet disputes with Labour leaders such as Attlee, whose goodwill the project depended on. Nor could he reflect on the deficiencies of generals such as Archibald Wavell or Claude Auchinleck, for fear they might sue him. Some, indeed, threatened to do so. Other deficiencies were of Churchill's own making. Although he described the fighting on the Eastern Front, he had little real interest in it, and no access to Soviet or German documents, so his account is a pastiche of secondary sources, largely written by his assistants. The same is true, to some extent, of the war in the Pacific, except for episodes such as the fall of Singapore, in which he was involved. His account of the US naval war in the Pacific was so heavily based on other writers that he was accused of plagiarism. The real focus of Churchill's work is always on the war in Western Europe, the Mediterranean, and North Africa. But here his work is based heavily on his own documents, so it greatly exaggerates his own role. He had little access to American documents, and even those he did have, such as his letters from Roosevelt, Truman, and Eisenhower, had to be used with caution for diplomatic reasons. Although he was, of course, a central figure in the war, he was not quite as central as his books suggest. Although he is usually fair, some personal vendettas were aired, against Sir Stafford Cripps, for example. The Second World War can still be read with great profit by students of the period, provided it is seen mainly as a memoir by a leading participant, rather than as an authoritative history by a detached historian. The war, and particularly the period between 1940 and 1942, when Britain was fighting alone, was the climax of Churchill's career, and his personal account of the inside story of those days is unique and invaluable. But since the archives have been opened, far more accurate and reliable histories have emerged. Churchill's History of the English-Speaking Peoples was commissioned and largely written in the 1930s, when Churchill badly needed money, but it was put aside when war broke out in 1939, being finally issued after he left office for the last time in 1955. Although it contains much fine writing, it shows Churchill's deficiencies as a historian at their most glaring. It is generally regarded as tendentious and very old-fashioned, seeing world history as a one-dimensional pageant of battles and speeches, kings and statesmen, in which the English occupy central stage. Events viewed by today's historians as being of central importance, such as the Industrial Revolution, are scarcely mentioned. Although Churchill's enormous prestige ensured that the books were respectfully received and sold well, they're little read today. Section 14. Churchill's War Cabinet, from May 1940 to May 1945. Winston Churchill, Prime Minister, Minister of Defence, and Leader of the House of Commons. Neville Chamberlain, Lord President of the Council. Clement Attlee, Lord Privy Seal and effective Deputy Leader of the House of Commons. Lord Halifax, Secretary of State for Foreign Affairs. Arthur Greenwood, Minister without Portfolio. Section 14.1. Changes. In August 1940, Lord Beaverbrook, a Canadian-British citizen, joined the War Cabinet as Minister of Aircraft Production. In October 1940, Sir John Anderson succeeded Neville Chamberlain as Lord President. Sir Kingsley Wood, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, and Ernest Bevin, the Minister of Labour, entered the War Cabinet. Lord Halifax assumes the additional job of Leader of the House of Lords. In December 1940, Anthony Eden succeeded Lord Halifax as Foreign Secretary. Halifax remained nominally in the Cabinet as Ambassador to the United States. His successor as Leader of the House of Lords was not in the War Cabinet. In May 1941, Lord Beaverbrook ceased his role as Minister of Aircraft Production, but remained in the Cabinet as Minister of State. His successor was not in the War Cabinet. In June 1941, he became Minister of Supply. In October 1941, Oliver Littleton entered the Cabinet as Minister Resident in the Middle East. On the 4th of February 1942, Lord Beaverbrook became Minister of War Production. His successor as Minister of Supply was not in the War Cabinet. On the 19th of February 1942, Lord Beaverbrook resigned and no replacement Minister of War Production was appointed for the moment. Clement Attlee became Secretary of State for Dominion Affairs and Deputy Prime Minister. Sir Stafford Cripps succeeded Attlee as Lord Privy Seal, and took over the position of Leader of House of Commons from Churchill. Sir Kingsley Wood left the War Cabinet, the remaining Chancellor of the Exchequer. On the 22nd of February 1942, Arthur Greenwood resigned from the War Cabinet. In March 1942, Oliver Littleton filled the vacant position of Minister of Production. War was dropped from the title. Richard Gardner Casey, a member of the Australian Parliament, succeeded Littleton as Minister Resident in the Middle East. In October 1942, Sir Stafford Cripps retired as Lord Privy Seal and Leader of the House of Commons and left the War Cabinet. His successor was not in the Cabinet, but Anthony Eden took the additional position of Leader of the House of Commons. The Home Secretary, Herbert Morrison, entered the Cabinet. In September 1943, Sir John Anderson succeeded Sir Kingsley Wood, who had died, as Chancellor of the Exchequer, remaining in the War Cabinet. Clement Attlee succeeded Anderson as Lord President, remaining also Deputy Prime Minister. Attlee's successor as Dominion Secretary was not in the Cabinet. In November 1943, Lord Woolton entered the Cabinet as Minister of Reconstruction. Section 15. Winston Churchill's Caretaker Cabinet, from May to July 1945. Winston Churchill, Prime Minister and Minister of Defence. Lord Woolton, Lord President of the Council. Lord Beaverbrook, Lord Privy Seal. Sir John Anderson, Chancellor of the Exchequer. Sir Donald Bradley Somerville, Secretary of State for the Home Department. Anthony Eden, Secretary of State for Foreign Affairs and Leader of the House of Commons. Oliver Stanley, Secretary of State for the Colonies. Lord Cranborne, Secretary of State for Dominion Affairs and Leader of the House of Lords. Sir P.J. Grigg, Secretary of State for War. Leo Amery, Secretary of State for India and Burma. Lord Rosebery, Secretary of State for Scotland. Harold Macmillan, Secretary of State for Air. Brendan Bracken, First Lord of the Admiralty. Oliver Littleton, President of the Board of Trade and Minister of Production. Robert Hudson, Minister of Agriculture. Rab Butler, Minister of Labour. Section 16. Winston Churchill's Third Cabinet, October 1951 to April 1955. Winston Churchill, Prime Minister and Minister of Defence. Lord Simmons, Lord Chancellor. Lord Woolton, Lord President of the Council. Lord Salisbury, Lord Privy Seal and Leader of the House of Lords. Rab Butler, Chancellor of the Exchequer. Sir David Maxwell Fife, Secretary of State for the Home Department. Anthony Eden, Secretary of State for Foreign Affairs. Oliver Littleton, Secretary of State for the Colonies. Lord Ismay, Secretary of State for Commonwealth Relations. James Stewart, Secretary of State for Scotland. Peter Thornycroft, President of the Board of Trade. Lord Cherwell, Paymaster General. Sir Walter Monckton, Minister of Labour. Harry Cruikshank, Minister of Health and Leader of the House of Commons. Harold Macmillan, Minister of Housing and Local Government. Lord Leathers, Minister for the Coordination of Transport, Fuel and Power. Section 16.1. Changes. In March 1952, Lord Salisbury succeeded Lord Ismay as Commonwealth Relations Secretary. Salisbury remained also Lord Privy Seal and Leader of the House of Lords. Lord Alexander of Tunis succeeded Churchill as Minister of Defence. In May 1952, Harry Cruikshank succeeded Lord Salisbury as Lord Privy Seal, remaining Leader of the House of Commons. Salisbury remained Commonwealth Relations Secretary and Leader of the House of Lords. Cruikshank's successor as Minister of Health is not in the Cabinet. In November 1952, Lord Woolton became Chancellor of the Duchy of Lancaster. Lord Salisbury succeeded Lord Woolton as Lord President. Lord Swinton succeeded Lord Salisbury as Commonwealth Relations Secretary. In September 1953, Florence Horsburgh, the Minister of Education, Sir Thomas Dugdale, the Minister of Agriculture, and Gwilym Lloyd George, the Minister of Food, entered the Cabinet. The Ministry for the Coordination of Transport, Fuel and Power was abolished, and Lord Leathers left the Cabinet. In October 1953, Lord Cherwell resigned as Paymaster General. His successor was not in the Cabinet. In July 1954, Alan Lennox Boyd succeeded Oliver Littleton as Colonial Secretary. Derek Heathcote Amory succeeded Sir Thomas Dugdale as Minister of Agriculture. And in October 1954, Sir David Maxwell Fyfe, now Lord Kilmure, succeeded Lord Simmons as Lord Chancellor. Gwilym Lloyd George succeeded him as Home Secretary. The Food Ministry was merged into the Ministry of Agriculture. Sir David Eccles succeeded Florence Horsburgh as Minister of Education. Harold Macmillan succeeded Lord Alexander of Tunis as Minister of Defence. Duncan Sandys succeeded Macmillan as Minister of Housing and Local Government. And Osbert Peake, the Minister of Pensions and National Insurance, entered the Cabinet. Section 17. References. The following books may be useful for information about Churchill. Churchill, A Life, by Martin Gilbert. Winston Churchill, by Henry Pelling. Winston Churchill, by Sebastian Hafner. The Last Lion, Winston Spencer Churchill, in 3 volumes, by William Manchester. Churchill, by Roy Jenkins. This sound file, and all text in the article, are licensed under the GNU Free Documentation License, available at www.gnu.org/copyleft/fdl.html.